Hi, everyone, and welcome to Remaking Tomorrow, a series of conversations about the future of teaching and learning. I'm Greg Baer, and today I have a guest co-host in the studio, Tyler Samstag, Executive Director of Remake Learning.
This is a podcast powered by Remake Learning, a network that ignites engaging and relevant learning in support of young people navigating rapid social and technological change.
And on today's episode, we're talking with Lisa Guernsey, Senior Director of Birth to 12th Grade Policy and Director of the Learning Sciences Exchange at New America. New America is a Washington, D.C. and Oakland, California-based think tank focused on a range of public policy issues, from education to the economy. Lisa, welcome to Remaking Tomorrow.
Thank you so much, Greg, and Tyler, too. Really happy to be with you guys.
I think we're the lucky ones, Lisa. Let's start with you. You wear so many professional hats as a leader at New America, and before that, you wore even more hats, from being a New York Times staff writer to an acclaimed researcher and writer on raising young children in this digital age. So Lisa, can you help our listeners understand who are you? What are the through lines in your work? When you wake up every morning, what is it that motivates to do the things that you do?
There have been many turns in the road for me, and I've come to my work from some pretty unconventional routes, but I do think that sometimes it's unconventional that helps us be able to see outside things. I started as a journalist and as a technology and education and kind of science writer. Even before that, I was really focused on writing feature stories and just trying to pull interest stories out of anything. But in my work as a reporter, I really zoomed in on how all sorts of different technologies were changing the way we as human beings, as parents, as learners, the way we act towards each other, the way we think, the way we learn, what makes us curious, what makes us want to explore. And I kept going with those themes in my work when I got to New America, where I was first brought on to just try to translate research on child development in ways that would make sense to policymakers and to broader audiences. But it can be really complicated. And then policy itself is really complicated. And the worlds of raising children, it's really complicated. So I've been all along just trying to find ways to make things more easy to understand, more engaging, more urgent, so that we all kind of recognize how important this work is. That's been a through line since the beginning.
We here at Remaking Tomorrow share many of your passions and interests, Lisa. And one of those shared passions is for learning ecosystems. We're thrilled to get to talk to you today about your work in leading the National Commission on Learning Ecosystems. But before we turn our attention to the National Commission, can you share with our listeners your understanding of the phrase learning ecosystems? What does that mean to you?
There's so much buzz around the concept of learning ecosystems, which is really thrilling. And I think some of that's because people are coming to it from their own contexts and their own understandings, and we want to capture and harness a lot of that. So we don't want to put so many constraints around these definitions of what this would be that people don't see themselves in the work. From where I stand and what we're working on and doing at New America, these are places. We're very much focused on place-based learning ecosystems in this new National Commission on Learning Ecosystems. And they're these geographically bound regions, communities, neighborhoods that are tapping into the assets across communities that are sites of learning for students and families, and certainly even young children before they're called students. And these sites of learning can include and should include, very much should include, schools, of course, public schools, school districts, but they also are including libraries and museums, after-school programs, recreation centers, apprenticeship programs that work with businesses in a community, post-secondary kind of campuses that are connected to schools and to various kinds of project-based learning that students can be doing. And any number of other places where you can come into that place and there's educators, there's program leads, there are mentors there to help students on their learning journey.
So I love that, Lisa. You've taken a potentially stratospheric idea and, as you've done in your entire career, just made it so plain. And I get it. I think all of our listeners get it. Which brings us then to that commission that Tyler mentioned, the National Commission on Learning Ecosystem. And over the next 2 years, we understand the commission will bring together leaders to share their insights and provide recommendations for scaling up, as you said, those place-based models of learning ecosystems. I can't help but ask, why now? What is it about this moment that calls for such an effort?
It feels like it's such an opportune moment to be examining what these ecosystems can do, elevating them, also interrogating them. And the reason I think that it's so opportune is because there is, I think, a huge kind of hunger and appetite right now to not just kind of uncover and to surface these kind of new ways of thinking, but to highlight what's already been there, sometimes in plain sight, that can help us feel very hopeful and positive about what opportunities are there for our kids. And there's a dire need right now to be helping people see that there are positive ways forward. There are people in our communities who every day are doing incredible work in, you know, turning the lights on for kids, right? Getting them activated and curious and wanting to learn more. And I personally think that we haven't done a very good job as kind of communicators in the world of media, certainly in the world of public policy. We have not been doing a very good job on shining a light on what's working. And I think it's important to do this kind of analysis, right? We do need to be looking for all of the things that are going wrong, and we got to try to fix them. But when we do that to such an extent that the broader message out there is that public education is not working, or the broader message out there is that you have to kind of seek something outside of your community to get your kids activated, then we've done a disservice and we haven't been able to show people what really is possible and what can work. We are at a really interesting, destabilizing moment when it comes to federal policy and how we think about what our education systems should look like and how they should be funded and how they should work. And we need to come up with some better answers. We need to be able to show a path forward. I will be the first to say we absolutely need more federal and state and local dollars in our education systems, no matter how we define them. But I know that right now we may be facing some of that reduction in funds. And so we have to find new ways to keep the energy going, ensure that more and more kids, especially kids without the financial resources at home and families that are under major economic hardship, to make sure that they are getting what they need.
And so, Lisa, what don't we yet know about learning ecosystems that you're hopeful to discover? And how will the National Commission go about searching for answers?
One of the things I'm interested in now that we have launched this National Commission is to explore through some of those roots what it really takes to help sustain good connections that can come in a learning ecosystem. Does it take making sure that we're starting at the early years and that we're recognizing the importance of families and family engagement? Does it take recognizing the importance of where kind of technology sits in our families' everyday world and in the way schools work? And then also certainly, how do we ensure we do some more cross-sector learning, and how do we bring in people from outside of what might be typically kind of considered public education so that they can be part of the picture and help inform what we do? I also just wanted to note that sustainability, of course, is a key question, but a second key question is impact. And so what we do want to do with this National Commission on Learning Ecosystems is to delve into questions of what kind of impact they're making on students' lives, on families' lives, on the way educators work with students, on course academic outcomes, but also on all sorts of other skills that we know our kids need.
This is Greg Baer, and I'm here with guest co-host Tyler Samstag. And we're talking with Lisa Guernsey, Senior Director of Birth to 12th Grade Policy and Director of the Learning Sciences Exchange at New America. So Lisa, I have just one more question about this national commission. And you started to answer it a moment ago, because I think about this as a parent. I'm a parent, you're a parent. And I can imagine our listeners who themselves are parents or they're teachers or they're caring adults who work with kids, and they're thinking like, so what? What's a big national commission have to do with my family or the kids that I know? How do you imagine the work of the National Commission finds its way to a family in Los Angeles or Austin or Pittsburgh and gives them and their neighborhoods and their communities the better answers that you say we need?
I just have to give a huge shout out to Remake Learning as a model that's provided so many kind of great resources and opened up minds. I am starting to think more about this learner journey. Like, what are the various paths that a child or adolescent could take to ensure that they're excited about learning? And so right now, in a non-ecosystem kind of way of thinking, that is just your kid is sitting in a classroom and gets some homework and then comes home and grumbles through it and turns something in and then goes to the next classroom and then the next day and then somehow gets a, you know, and gets a diploma at the end. And once in a while feels like, okay, I learned something, but a lot of times feels like, this doesn't feel relevant to me. I don't know what I'm going to do with this. I struggled through it. That's the dystopian, right? And in a learning ecosystem model, there can be such a different, much brighter pathway for that student that can, of course, it involves being in a classroom and having interactions with a teacher, but it also could mean that you are connected to or learn about working out in the field with, a biologist who's collecting stream water for a particular project. And that is helping you understand the biology homework in a much deeper way. And you're getting outside and you're connecting with your community and you're starting to see how relevant these kinds of topic areas are to what you want to learn. Or you're starting to have a pathway towards seeing yourself as, say, an artist or a performer. And there's people in your school and in your community who are helping you to connect to auditions or places where you can learn how to be part of a band or connect in deeper ways to learning how to kind of speak in front of people and recording those instances and doing maybe some of the multimedia work of your own. And that's happening in a way that helps you, again, feel connected to something, feel like there's some purpose to what you're doing and that you're building some skills at the same time.
I love that. Thank you, Lisa. We mentioned before that you wear many hats at New America. And one of those, as you mentioned, is directing the Learning Sciences Exchange, a groundbreaking two-year fellowship for building cross-sector skills to research and to catalyze educational change. Lisa, can you tell us about the fellowship and the work that it has helped to propel forward?
Yeah, the Learning Sciences Exchange started in 2018 based on a brainstorm, really, that I had along with my co-founders, Kathy Hirsch-Pasek and Roberta Golenkoff. So the two of them have been incredible just mentors, and they're very inspiring. This is years back, but we kind of came together to say, you know, there's something that's missing here. There's a lot of great science that's coming out in all of these journals, from science, you know, on research and child development to cognitive neuroscience, behavioral science pieces. And then there's what's happening in the real world. It's not connected in any way to what these scientists are starting to learn. Because I came from the world of journalism, I knew that it's not easy to be able to kind of go deep enough and to really understand what's going on. And sometimes everything's just so headline driven, and you might not even recall a certain scientist. You might just like regurgitate something that you saw in their report, and you never go deep enough. So we wanted to figure out a way to help there be much better bi-directional communication between journalists and learning scientists. But then we decided to take it even bigger, and we're like, wait a second, it shouldn't be just journalists and scientists. We really need other communicators in the mix. We need the people who work in the world of entertainment and storytelling, who understand how to really engage people in these issues and help them feel kind of emotionally connected to them. And we also need social impact entrepreneurs who know how to get things done and like build kind of startups that have a social impact lens. And of course, we need those who understand education policy and recognize kind of the education system. So we pulled on education leaders to be part of this as well. And so it formed in 2018 by kind of pulling together all these different groups. And then we put out a call for applications. You know, who wants to join us and be part of the first class of our fellows? We got huge response from that, which was incredibly exciting. And over the years, we've had six different cohorts of fellows now. Sometimes they've worked for 2 years on projects, sometimes just one. But what kind of sets them apart from other fellows programs is not only do they come together to just share each other's work, but they are tasked with creating something. They're all put on teams, and they have in a time-limited way and with a little bit of funding, they are asked to build something new that would help to solve an education problem by applying the science of learning and by also applying all those other skills that I mentioned. And that's just been incredibly fun to see what unfolds from that, right? We need to tap into this cross-sector thinking.
We all want to be Lisa, right? Like, you pool together storytellers and scientists and entrepreneurs and work on problems together. And sometimes you're a historian too, because you have another cool project at New America that you've been leading called the 1939 Library Sit-In Project. Can you tell us about this project? And maybe as you do, help us understand how looking to the past can help us build a better future.
This is a passion project of mine, but it's also, I've of course pulled in all sorts of people at New America and through various circles to join in with me on this. So the 1939 Library Sit-In Project is something we started in 2022, but it's come out of this new attention that's been turned toward a story that most people who, even those who are historians of civil rights, most people do not know the story. In August 21st, 1939, in Alexandria, Virginia, just less than a mile from where I'm sitting right now, there was a library that had opened less than 2 years before that was the only public library in the community. And it was a library that a young man named Samuel Tucker wanted to go visit. He wanted to get a library card. He wanted to use the library. He was a young Black man. He was not allowed to go into that library because of the color of his skin. Jim Crow laws across the South of that time, but what that meant was that these libraries were built to only serve white residents. So he, a brilliant young man, at the age of 26, he had finished at Howard University, could have gone to law school, decided, no, I'll just go ahead and try for the bar, Virginia bar, without even going to law school, passed the bar the first try. So he was a lawyer at age 26 who was working with his brother, Otto Tucker, who was just a little bit younger than him, to try to figure out how to bring attention to this complete injustice, this utter discrimination that was happening just down the street from their home. They pulled together friends. They called the press to get them ready. This is the African-American press at the time. That morning on August 21st, got together and one by one, quietly, in a very orderly way, dressed in suits and hats, each went into the library, each requested a library card, each were denied. And instead of leaving the library, they sat down and started to read quietly. It led to a total paralyzation on the part of the librarians there who did not know what to do. They called the police. The five men were arrested and escorted out of the library. The press were there, took all sorts of pictures, and this became actually front page news at the time in 1939. However, 12 days later, World War II started. And so this got buried. And there's lots of other reasons as to why it got buried as well. But it wasn't until some work of incredible librarians, archivists, museum curators, and of course, many of the African-American community members kind of held onto the story and kept the pieces of it. And it has been now retold and is part of the Alexandria Black History Museum's exhibits. This project involves digitizing all of the print records that are in the Alexandria Library, all sorts of old newspaper articles and letters. It also involves including video oral histories. And then we're also building tools for teachers so that there can be instructional resources to use in the classroom, including some interactive maps and all sorts of ways of being able to use digitized materials to help engage young people in this story.
You are a prolific writer, Lisa. You've written for the New York Times. You've authored multiple books, including Tap, Click, Read, Growing Readers in a World of Screens, and Screen Time, How Electronic Media, from Educational Software to Baby Videos, Affect Your Young Child. As these titles suggest, you've thought a great deal about children's learning amid ever-present screens and technology. How have these writing experiences shaped your views on the future of learning in this digital age?
It is a question that animates everything I do. How do we function in this world today? And how do we keep learning? How do we keep the kind of human element of learning going? The one thing that I come back to throughout a lot of this work is the science of social interaction and how important that is to the way we learn and the way our brains retain information, the way we kind of store and recall what we know, the way we learn to cooperate, collaborate, communicate with each other. I just have to just give a big shout out to the researchers from years ago who started to focus on how much social interaction matters, but also what it looks like to do that through different media. And when is it being curtailed? And when are we not getting what we need because technology is blocking our ability to have the social interactions, the really healthy, authentic social interactions that we need?
Well, Lisa, that's going to have to be an entirely different podcast all about what it means to be human and act in an ever human way in a world of ever accelerating technologies. We want to close today's podcast sort of where we began, and that is about you. And we have a lot of fun here at Remaking Tomorrow with what we call the lightning round. So I'll ask you a couple questions and you just give the first answers that come to mind. You ready to play?
Okay, this sounds good.
All right. Your favorite story that you wrote for the New York Times?
I wrote about techno blight many years ago. It was about how ugly it is when you're driving down the road and you see all the telephone poles with all the electric lines everywhere. That was a blast to write.
You know what makes me think of that Shel Silverstein poem? I hope that I shall never see a billboard lovely as a tree. Indeed, unless the billboards fall, I shall never see a tree at all. The New York Times story you most wish you had written yourself or that someone still needs to write?
I think there have been some excellent stories about what's happening with children's literacy skills and whether they're reading or not reading and why. And there's some troubling information, statistics out there and surveys around how children are not really reading for fun anymore. And I don't feel like we've fully unpacked why that is. I do think people, you know, like to say it's because of the screens, but I don't think that's the whole story. I would love to have even more reporting on that.
And Lisa, we hope you're reading for fun these days because we're curious. What are you reading?
I'm in the middle of one of the Frederick Bachman books, my friends. I just love kind of diving into novels like that. I also have on my bedside table, James Baldwin book, Go Tell It on the Mountain, because his writing is incredible and always very inspiring to read kind of as I still kind of see myself as a wannabe writer, honestly. And so I'm going to learn from the greats like him.
Lisa, before we go, we have just one more question, and that's this. What's one thing that parents and educators can do today to make tomorrow a more promising place for every learner?
If we all take a minute to slow down and just tune into our kids, asking them, what are you interested in right now? Or why are you finding that so cool? I just feel like those kinds of moments to tune into our kids are precious and we need more of them.
Thanks again to Lisa Guernsey, Senior Director of Birth to 12th Grade Policy and the Director of the Learning Sciences Exchange at New America. Remaking Tomorrow is powered by Remake Learning. Learn more at remakelearning.org.